Welcome to Vox Vomitus, also known as Word Vomit.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of Vox Vomitus. I am your host, Jennifer Ann Gordon, the author of Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent, as well as Pretty Ugly. Joining me today, as always, is my Vox Vomitus vixen, Allison Martine, the co-hostess with the mostess. Allison is the author of The Bourbon Books, which includes Dibs, which just celebrated its 3-year book birthday yesterday.
She's a toddler.
She's a toddler now. So Dibs is 3 since September. Move On, Melinda, and Climb the Salmon Ladder. It's weird to refer to a romance book as a toddler.
Maybe I shouldn't say that.
I know. I'm like, that's weird.
There are no toddlers in my book.
No toddlers in the book. We are here with a very special guest today, Rachel Kopelke-Dale, author of, I'm only going to be able to hold up one, The Ballerinas, and also The Ingenue. She is joining us from Paris. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for not doing this interview in French, because I don't speak it.
I get at least 10% dumber in French. So
I my God, I wish I had like a fake cigarette now so I could just like pretend to be French.
Just a stereotype. That's good.
The stereotype. Just a beret.
My favorite thing is to get French people to tell me what English sounds like to them if they don't speak it. And they're like,
you're like,
you're like, overly brown adults.
You're like, that is how we sound. I know it is.
Such a beautiful language, English.
So, Rachel, again, I kind of stalked you on Instagram after I read both of your books. And it was just like, I just need her on the show. I need her on the show. I love it so much.
Thank you.
And I heard about you first from our good friend, Megan Collins, the author of The Family Plot. She was posting about your books on Instagram. And I immediately was like, ballerinas, dark, thrill. Yes, already bought.
Those may have been Megan's only posts that weren't either about her own books or Taylor Swift. So you should feel honored because it's mostly Taylor Swift.
Incredibly honored. And she's a wonderful writer.
She's amazing.
We love her.
So Rachel, tell our viewers and our listeners a little bit about you, how you got to Paris, and a little bit about the Ingenue.
Absolutely. So I'm originally from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which I love, but is in many ways the opposite of Paris.
It's the Paris of Wisconsin.
No, it's not. Madison's probably the Paris of Wisconsin. Well, it's a great city, and I do love
anything
it.
In Wisconsin equivalent to Paris. I mean, maybe the cheese. Let's just go with they both cheese. Are renowned for cheese. Let's celebrate the.
There you go. That is a good connection. And I came here first as a kid and fell in love. It's like such the stereotypical cliche of, you know, just being kind of thunderstruck, and studied abroad here. And when I studied abroad, we met the French students who were exchanging like universities with us, and they, you know, they mentioned in passing, like, they were like, we're getting a great deal because we're paying, you know, public university fees in France, which is like 200 euros a semester. And we're like, we can't tell our parents this. Like, no.
Absolutely. All the Americans are currently sobbing in student loan debt right now when they hear that. It's like,
whew. I know, that really just like hurt my soul as somebody who like just last year finally paid off her student loan.
Well, and I went to the UC system, so I got the best deal in public education. But even that, 200 euros, I'm just like, that was a book. And go.
Yeah. And so when I wanted to do my master's degree, you know, I thought, well, you know, actually, I could do it in Paris. I could get health insurance for like a little bit more than that at like 200 euros a year as a student. I'm dating myself. This is pre Obamacare. And, you know, I was no longer on my parents' health insurance. So it seemed like a very practical decision as far as getting a master's in film can ever be a practical decision.
I mean, well, you are talking to somebody who went to school for theater and then went back to school for art history, just racking up the degrees that I'm like, money maker.
Renaissance woman with those practical degrees there that you hang on the walls.
That's it.
You gotta and now we're all writers. It's like, oh.
There you go. Well, you know, and I think that's important because you know, you get inspiration from everywhere. So,
so you went to school for film in Paris. That just sounds so exhausting.
I should say, my father, who was an actual filmmaker, would murder me because it was film studies. I've never been behind a camera in my life.
Did he just say that's it? It's like worse than being, sorry, Jen, the redheaded stepchild, the filmmaker's daughter who's like, film studies? No, get out of my house.
Well, I mean, I feel like that's why when I went to school for art history, I love art, but I'm not a great artist. And I was just like, how can I make this somehow still a job that will never pay me any money?
I know. Hey, museum docent. That's what I want to do when I retire. But I don't even have the art history degree. So I just be like, I'll volunteer and I'll read all the little blurbs you give me.
But when that's I worked in art gallery, I hadn't even gone back to school for art history yet. I was still just a graduate with a theater major. So my only art job was before
you had the credentials. Schooling. We won't tell anybody. It's fine. Just everybody watching.
Everybody watching.
Now, writing this down. It's fine. They're not going to check.
Fun facts about the hosts of Vox Vomitus. They're doing nothing with their college degrees.
They're doing this, and that's the most important.
Okay, so, but Rachel, you probably had to do some writing while you were studying the film studies. But then when did you switch from, okay, I'm going to do film to I'm going to put stuff on paper instead?
Well, I'd always written. My parents are also both writers. And so that was, we're a little bit like a circus family. My little sister's a poet. She has a wonderful book called Seeking the Pink. My older sister writes a lot in her work as well. And yeah, so I'd always wanted to do that, but I didn't get the chance until I moved to London to do my PhD, because a lot of the feedback I got here was like, your written French is,
French is hard. Please go find an English-speaking country. We have one next door.
Your written it's French looks out. Like hieroglyphics, and we don't know what you're saying.
And I was there with, at the same time that my close friend from college, Jess Pan, moved there for entirely different reasons.
And she's your co-writer, isn't she, for Graduates in Wonderland?
For Graduates in Wonderland, yeah, which is the memoir that we wrote together in 2014. And that was actually, we'd had a pact when we were between college and the time that book came out, that we would email every week. And it just happened that, like, yeah, it started out, I was in New York, she was in China. Then I moved to France, she moved to Australia. And then various things happened. We both ended up in England and we were like, we're together. And like, we don't have these emails anymore. I miss those emails. Like, we had some good emails. So we started like just putting them together and, you know, loved it and thought, you know, this is kind of fun and maybe other people would enjoy, you know, reading this too. And so Graduates in Wonderland was born. And after that, I think we both had the bug and just wanted to keep writing. Her second book came out recently, Sorry I'm Late, I Didn't Want to Come, which was
the story of Jennifer Ann Gordon. She wrote my life story, everybody.
Yeah, it's about fantastic.
Sorry I'm late. I didn't want to come. I'm reading it based on that.
Oh, the US cover is amazing. She actually she got a cake, you know, and actually wrote the title in frosting. It's so good.
I love it.
That's, oh my gosh, this is like combining everything I like. Not going out, cake.
Exactly.
Done.
And a book.
Yeah. And a book. I forgot the book.
It doesn't get better than that.
We're going to need to have her on the show at some point, mostly as an excuse for me to eat cake on the show, because if I can work in a food reference, I will, and I like cake, so we're good.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. So she's continued writing nonfiction and memoir, and I took a turn into fiction. So I finished the PhD and I was like, well, that's done. I'm not going to be a professor. So.
Yeah, I've spent enough time in school. I've done everything I possibly can. So that's when you decided to write The Ballerinas?
That's it.
And you did study classical ballet, correct?
I did. I stopped when I was 15. So a lot of
it ruins your body.
I want to see what your feet look like. How bad are your toes?
My toes are okay because I was only on point for, 3 years in a bit.
I'm sorry. I was only so 3 years. Jealous. I'm like, your feet are still fine.
I mean, they're not gorgeous, but, you know, comparatively, like my friends who turned professional have a lot more issues, for sure. But yeah, I had hip problems and kind of had to, you know, had the first time in my life that I could step back and take stock and just go, well, you know, what's my body looking like? What are my career options? And what else do I want, you know, do I want to do that? Because it's kind of the point where you're already in class, you know, between kind of 2 and 4 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it was really a blessing to be able to just step back and have that moment of reflection. And then I couldn't believe once I quit ballet, I hadn't had a free Saturday probably in years.
What is this day of the week called? What are people doing out here in the daylight?
Like, what do, can I like read a book? What do I do?
Like, can I eat it like a bunch of snacks?
Yeah.
So I did ballet until my knees gave out and I had to stop. And then I switched to jazz. And then again, I danced for so long. I was like, my body isn't a dancer body per se. Though technically my day job is I am a professional
dancer, Jennifer.
That's why my feet are still ruined.
Right. But you're not like, doing anything on point though.
No, but for years, for 10 years, I did wear the 5-inch ballroom dance heels.
Oh.
And now I wear dance sneakers. Pandemic.
Well, flat shoes and soft pants from here on out for me.
No, I didn't know there were, what are 5-inch dance heels? I didn't even know that was a thing. I know character shoes.
Oh yeah. These are like Latin shoes. They're open toed or like a tango shoe with like between a 4 and a 5-inch like stiletto heel that has a rod down it. So it's real strong.
So it's a murder weapon. Go on.
It's a murder weapon. I mean.
But Allison, you know, character shoes. Did you also do ballet?
Okay, so I refer to myself as theater adjacent because my ex-husband was an actor. So everything I mostly know is from him, not from me. I swam in high school, so my feet are fine. But I took one dance class, just the one, in college, and it was jazz. So I was able to not hurt my feet because I was wearing just, you know, the little jazz shoes. And I still have them because for some reason, I think maybe one day I will need them.
You will.
No, I won't.
Because I'm going to come visit you, and you're going to do like a dance workshop.
But I'm like the least coordinated. I have no ability to dance. Yeah, no, I was marching band, so my feet just go up and down, and I can keep a rhythm that way, and I can keep a straight line, and I'm really good at
dance. Is just fancy walking.
Yeah, it's not just fancy, but I'm very undancy. But I've been to many dance concerts, and in my head, I have choreographed all of Ben Folds Five, the unauthorized biography of Reinhold Meisner, as a dance concert. But I just have to be like, yeah, do that, because I don't know the names of any of these moves. It's just all in my head. So things I can't do, choreograph.
So I obsessively read like any dance book that I can get my hands on, especially when they're described as like dark and twisty and there's a secret that happens in the past that haunts people now. And I'm like, oh, it's everything I like. So thank you for writing The Ballerinas. And the second I was done with that, I purchased the Ingenue, which is, and we would like you to talk a little bit about the Ingenue because Allison and I both read that.
I listened with my ears. So
she listened to it. The second I was done, I'm like, Allison, I'm going to stop Rachel online.
Yeah. And try to get amazing narrator Stephanie Willis actually won a big audio award for her narration on that. She is just incredible. Yeah. So the Ingenue is Midwestern Gothic. It is set in my hometown of Milwaukee, and it's about a former piano prodigy who quit one day when she was 18 for mysterious reasons. And she's now in her late 30s, and she's come home on her mother's death, expecting to inherit this kind of sizable family estate.
The Elf House.
With gargoyles.
The Elf House, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I understand why you named it the Ingenue, but you totally could have called it the Elf House. I would have bought that, too. Totally.
I would have bought it, too. I was like, the house was another character.
Oh, absolutely.
I was just like, more descriptions of the house, please.
I am a house obsessive, and this is based on a couple real houses in Milwaukee. That I later found out the one with the elves out front, they're actually gnomes, but Gnome House didn't have the right ring.
Gnome House sounds too whimsy.
It's cutesy, and you're thinking of like garden gnomes just hanging out in your lawn, and
it doesn't have that darkness. So so she thinks she's going to inherit this house, and she finds out that her mother left it to a mysterious kind of family friend.
I know. And I'm like, I don't know how much we can talk about certain things.
Yeah. Well, and even how you introduced
that spoiler show, but
yeah, no, we got to keep it spoiler free, but I like how you introduced like this person just by name, and we were getting so little early. I'm like, who the hell is this person? And why am I feeling this way about this character that hasn't even been fully introduced, but I'm just like churning as I'm reading. I'm like, I don't think that's good.
Yeah, I mean that's quiz comes about 4 pages in, so it's not a huge
but there are certain things that we can't mention that
no
good job though. And I feel like I love that you just called it Midwestern Gothic, because that is definitely what it is. I was reading it and I'm like, this isn't a thriller. It's not a horror novel.
I even asked you and you said it's being promoted as a thriller. She's like, but it's not a thriller. So now I'm liking knowing it's gothic, or is Milwaukee Noir a thing?
Milwaukee Noir.
Yeah, it could be. I'm just saying that. I think it's a tricky book to place. And, you know, I do fear that readers come to it, you know, with thriller expectations, you know, and because it isn't solidly within that genre at all. But on the other hand, I do think that it's a good category for it to be in on some level, because I want readers to know this is dark, you know, this is not going to be.
Oh, and the tension is huge. So there's so much tension through it, but it's not necessarily the kind of tension you'd get in a traditional thriller as far as what's causing the tension. But the tension is,
palpable. I'm going to bring up a dance book, but it gave me vibes like Megan Abbott's The Turnout.
Oh, she is one of my favorites.
I mean, hallelujah. Yeah. Like, no matter how much I stalk her, she hasn't come on our show.
She's going to ignore us, you know.
She's going to keep ignoring it.
She might not be real. I don't know.
She's doing, you know, a book every year, every other year. She is busy and prolific.
Yeah. Yes. But, and she, again, a lot of her books are like labeled as thrillers. And then you're like, it's not a thriller, but there is this like drumbeat of dread from day one that I just think is, and that is what the ingenue reminded me of.
Oh, thank you so much. That's such a high compliment.
You're like, oh my God, I gotta go now.
You say that drumbeat of dread, that's absolutely what's going on. Even from the start, when you're just even talking about the house, and I'm just like, this house, I'm waiting for the house to do something. And it almost even leads to a point where you think it's something supernatural going to happen, but that's not the turn it takes either. So it's like, I think calling it gothic is a great way to put it, because it kind of captures all that dread without it being traditionally in. Well, and then we go all stabby stabby or something.
And there's so many, we'll call them like mini mysteries throughout, which is, you know, why did she quit the piano?
Yeah.
Who is this mysterious family friend exactly? Mm-hmm. What particularly was going on in her mother's last days when she was ill? Like so many mini mysteries that led up to this incredible ending.
Oh, thank you.
We'll talk about ending when we're not live.
I know. I'm like, and I'm not going to tell anybody the incredible ending, but yes.
We can just call it incredible, and then they have to read it and they can have a conversation with us about it later. But not
Absolutely. So, Rachel, do you play the piano?
I played very badly growing up. My mother is.
I have stubby fingers.
Hi, yeah.
Oh boy.
I remember my teacher was like, you'll never have piano hands. And I'm like, no, I have like the hands of a 4-year-old forever.
And mine are a little swollen right now from some thyroid stuff. But my mom has the same hands, and she's an incredible pianist. She's like, you can fake, like, you know, you can fake some of the stuff. There are pieces that you can't play, but it's very like.
What's your reach like? I mean, I'm telling you, there's certain requirements there. We talk about also organist hands, and they all have large hands and these massive feet with their special shoes. I mean, I know more about the church organ than I should, but you have to, because you're playing with the feet and the hands and doing all the stops and everything. And there's like certain physical requirements that I am never going to meet.
Well, but that is true for only, according to my mother, who, as I said, is a talented amateur pianist, a handful of piano pieces, so to speak, no pun intended.
And, I know, I'm like, we see what you did there.
And
look, I'm grabbing boobs. I don't know what I'm doing.
I'm like, uh-oh.
This is not how you play the piano.
This is going to be a screenshot for this week. You and I going like. We were talking about piano.
Oh, clearly no. Knowing so much about music that we think that's how the piano is played. Anyway. But your mother's probably right that most things you can either fake or work your way around. You know, you don't always need to have the massive octave spanning hands to do it.
That's it. But like, that wasn't my problem at all. My problem was that I just never kind of realized that I was supposed to get by. Yeah, I was just like, I was like, I don't know. What did I think it was as a kid? It was just like, I went to this lady's house once a week and just like played piano for her, like got a little bit yelled at and went home and then just did it again the next week. And like, it just, the process, and it's like, I took dance classes. Like I understood how to, I was supposed to improve there.
Yeah.
I'm laughing because that was like exactly my life. I'm just like, I was able to dance for 2 hours every day and go home and practice that. But then I never once practiced the piano that I remember. And I think I
outside of your actual lesson.
Yep. And I remember them saying, "You're not getting any better." And I was like, yeah, I know, it's weird. Why are you not progressing? You can't even be in the recital. I'm like, I don't know.
Very strange.
Very strange. Yeah. And I think for me too, like I had this idea of, you know, like with lessons and things that you just start out and be amazing, you know, which never happened to me, but like just from books of kids starting things, because it's like the hard work and like that's pretty boring to read about.
Look, you know? Those 80s montages have completely misled all of us that you're maybe pretty good to start and then you become amazing. But if you were like, I'm not
just
even pretty good.
Kind of wanted a little bit. And all of maybe. That happens during the scope of like one song by Chopin.
That's right.
Once Eye of the Tiger is over.
And then all of a sudden, like 2 months later, there's a standing ovation.
Mm-hmm.
As a child.
That was not my experience.
No.
So what made you decide to write about a pianist?
I've always been fascinated with the idea of prodigies, particularly because I wasn't one.
Must be nice for them.
Nice and then not so nice. And kind of to me too, this idea of like a millennial prodigy, you know, would have larger implications for kind of like boomer, like generational tensions and you know, discussions around that I thought was so interesting. So I knew I wanted to write about a prodigy. And there are certain areas in which you can be a prodigy. Like there aren't really dance prodigies. You do have like baby ballerinas, you know, from like 60s and 70s, but it's like, people have been doing this for years and years and years.
And like, I hate to quote Fred Astaire, but I'm going to, but he said, there is no such thing as a naturally born dancer. Everyone is trained.
That's it.
And I was going to say, I know a young lady who goes to our church and she's amazing. And I would, as an untrained person, assume she's a prodigy. But then I remember her mother is a dancer and that child has been in ballet flats since she was in baby booties. So she lives, eats, and breathes dance. So is she naturally gifted? Absolutely. Would she think of herself as a prodigy? Probably not, even though she's absolutely amazing. But again, it's all training.
Yeah. And it's the same thing with writing. Like, I don't think there are writing prodigies. Because you, even people who publish really, really young tend to have, you know, that one book, you know, the because you need the life experience. You know, these are forms, they're crafts that you learn and that you also have to have something to say through, I think. So, you know.
I'm sorry, we all laughed because we're like,
I
remember the craft we wrote.
You know, I didn't have anything that I thought people needed to hear. Some people do, and that's amazing, but I think it's really, really rare. I think things that are more mathematical, like music, are slightly, people just, sometimes their brains are just wired for it.
Yeah, and I was going to say the prodigies I think of are math and chess.
Yep.
Math, chess, violin.
There's a lot of similarities, a lot of crossover with like math prodigies and musical prodigies, because music is incredibly mathematical.
Oh yeah.
Oh, that's why I was terrible at it.
Well, and I was going to say, so I never played piano. My musical background was more vocal when I was little. And then when I got to junior high, I started playing clarinet. I was decent at the clarinet, but I always was held back by the fact that I can't do scales. And they're like, it's just math. I'm like, you're explaining exactly why I can't do it. And I still remember one year, our band director, I nailed the hardest run on our parade march. And he looked at me, he's like, how come you can do that and you can't do your scales? I'm like, because this is music and that's math.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because I can do a melody, sure, my hands can do it, but you just want me to keep figuring out, wait, now this is the sharps? And it's just...
And hey, look, you're talking to two dancers. We can only count to eight.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, that's true. There's only eight notes. Really? Lots of sharps.
Go back.
But only goes through G, as far as I'm concerned.
No, but that's, you know, and my mom is an incredible abstract thinker, you know, and she's, I think for that reason, she's wonderful with poetry. She loves finding, you know, really strange, you know, forms and, you know, and forms from centuries ago and things like that. And that's not how my brain works, but I love thinking about people who think differently. So that was a fun kind of project to set myself to, as somebody who's not at all interested in the same things I am. Because of course, ballet and choreography from the first book was so, it didn't take any stretch to pretend to be interested in it. Mm-hmm. And then going, okay, but how is Saskia thinking? And, you know, she's not me at all, really. You know,
so. I know, it's tricky
she
when
played
you...
the piano between lessons, unlike some people, Jennifer and Rachel both.
Well, like, look. We were tired from standing on our tiptoes for hours.
I know. I was marching around a field and going, well, if I'm one dot and then the dot makes a pretty picture, I better be in the right place.
It's beautiful.
Oh my gosh. Okay, but so, you mentioned mom, because your mom is an abstract thinker. And the other main character who is dead before the book even starts is Saskia's mom. And Jen and I were talking just before you hopped on how we both love books that have like book within a book. Okay, Jennifer's putting on her crown. In
for those of you, my crown is bent and sad.
Your crown
it's
is
in
bent.
My burlesque drawer, but then I realized that's the perfect crown for a fairy tale for a little feminist. And my little I kind of look like Jughead though.
You kind of do. Don't put it that far over. We're gonna start seeing if you're one of the lost Sprouse siblings. You don't want that.
Yeah, the fairy tales for little feminists, they start every chapter, but
I want to read that whole book.
Is there a whole book somewhere?
The whole book.
I'm a middle grade author.
I don't know that there's a market for it today, except
maybe there is.
Yeah.
I think there is.
But we'll
I'm
see.
Like, I want to see the illustrations.
Mm-hmm.
I want to read the complete, all of them.
Actually, as a pre-order promo for this, we did like I had, what was it, seven different artists each pick their favorite fairy tale to illustrate, and then just kind of did what they want with it. And so, yeah, artists from around the world, it was amazing and really fun to see the different interpretations. But
do you have a favorite fairy tale?
Oh, my favorite. I've always loved the Snow Queen. I loved anything with snow, and I think that's just Nutcracker.
The
Trump.
Milwaukee of it all.
Yeah,
I was gonna say, you're from Milwaukee. It's familiar to you there.
I do miss the snow. We get it maybe once a year in Paris, and it never sticks. But of course, I go, you know, to my parents at Christmas, and I'm like, oh, there's a foot of snow, and they're just like, oh, you know, that's a shovel.
I live in New Hampshire. It's like we're done. I can't do it anymore. Every year, I'm like, it's -47. Why do I live here?
Yeah, and I live in
here. Like, it's magical. And
your mom's like, no. Well, and my kids found out that it wasn't so magical because where we live, it does not snow. And I guess we had like the slightest dusting at one day. We didn't even notice. I thought it was hail. But we went up to a day for snow tubing. And my kids are like, it's hard. They thought it was like cotton. My guys, it's not cotton candy. It's cold. It's ice. Yeah,
it's sharp. It weirdly cut you.
Yeah, all of them had like a cartoon idea of what snow is. And I'm like, you guys are so Californian. This is sad.
Oh, that's so cute.
It's adorable.
I totally
their dreams were crushed.
Yeah, no, they needed it. Mm-hmm.
It's not a snow globe life. These are pieces of ice.
No, well, and I think that's part of it is they've played with some fake snow before at things where it is like made with powdered soap and stuff. And it's
and plastic bags, shredded plastic bags.
Yeah, it's light and fluffy. And even then, my youngest was mad because he kept saying it was fake snow because they had a snow machine adding to it. I'm like, that's so that you don't hit the little bumps on your way down and crack your skull open. It's just to make it flat, guys. It's not any less real than the stuff that fall from the sky. You can't go molecule by this one came from the machine. This one came from the sky.
Trust me, as somebody who's accidentally eaten fake snow on stage, you can tell when it's fake because you're like, that is definitely a melting piece of plastic in my mouth.
Why are we eating it?
Well, because there's like a moment in Christmas Carol where it snows and everyone is like, ah, and we're singing. And I wasn't trying to eat it, but like it just goes into your mouth and you're like, I'm getting cancer right now.
Yeah, no. Yeah. And I've been full on smog to the face with the smoke machine with that stuff. And that has a very distinctive fun smell and taste, but I didn't try to eat it. It was just, well, when the choreography has you drop to the ground and then it pops up, maybe that's not the best idea because it's like right in the eyeballs. And this is before I had glasses. I didn't even have eye protection. I'm fine.
So I'm going to... Right kind of before we went live, we were talking about our outfits and Allison and I were like trying to dress like whatever we thought an ingenue was. Sorry, people watching the video. We're not ingenues.
No, we're not. I'm like 40 years past ingenue.
Ditto. And Rachel, you said, I was going to wear my riding costume, but that's not the same book. I'm like, can you tell us a little bit about whatever this next book is? Does it have a release date?
Just clarifying, because at first I thought you said writing with a W. Like, this is what I wear to write. I'm like, you have an outfit for writing? I don't have an outfit for writing.
No, mine's sad pajamas. An
outfit for writing. Yeah, it's called sweats. But we're talking ride like giddy up. And you were mentioning something about a whip, and we were talking about how that whip might confuse people.
I said a whip is always fine to bring on the show.
It actually is, but it might confuse people. That's all.
This is how the ingenue learned to play so well.
And Western super gothic. Yeah. No, the next book is called The Fortune Seller. It comes out with St. Martin's on... in mid-February next year of 2024. It is about an Ivy League equestrian team in the mid-2000s and kind of a mysterious stranger who infiltrates this elite group of young women.
Yes.
And it's all...
Is the stranger a horse?
It's tarot cards and horses, yep.
Oh my, I have the perfect outfit to wear when you come back.
Of course you do!
Excellent. I can bring my helmet and everything.
Mine's like an actual horse head.
Why do you have a horse? I don't even know why I'm asking this. I don't want to know. I don't want to know why you have a horse head.
David Lynch inspired burlesque number where everybody had like a parakeet head or a cat face.
Amazing.
It was not sexy.
I thought you were
ended up getting cut from the show because at the end, I was the creative director and even I was like,
this is too weird.
I don't think people want this.
No. I hope you videotaped it. I want to see that. And as soon as you said parakeet head, you haven't read Paul Tremblay's Growing Things yet, have you? Okay, yeah, bird heads. I'm never getting those images out of my head. So please, no bird heads, no horse heads. This is not The Godfather.
It's plastic. It's a mask.
To like the English riding gear and look all prim and cute and stuff with the boots. I have boots that kind of look
boots. Like, I have like a little blazer.
The problem is our feet are usually not in this shot. So I'd have to be sitting there like, I'm
nervous. Well, the one time I had like, I know, I was just about to bring up my like bare gross dance foot.
Feet?
We had cowboy boots near us during one episode, but we were like, nobody's going to know we're wearing cowboy boots. So we were just like, kept like picking them up. And
mine was my kid's boot. So I wasn't wearing it. It was one of my kids.
Mine were dance boots.
Dance boots. But the riding boots.
That's why they were so flamboyantly orange.
I just want to know, like, Rachel, I feel like you have akin to the audience who writes like Family Guy episodes, is where they just pull random things and weave them together. It's like tarot and writing, fairy tales and piano. Like, where do you get these ideas and just pull them all together and go, yeah, you know, we're going to have fairy tales and the piano player and now tarot and horse riding. Where do you just like pull two strange things out or like pull them out of a hat? How do these things come for you?
Magic eight ball.
Yeah, seriously.
Well, so I did take just an extraordinary number of lessons as a kid, as I said, searching for that.
Of every kind, so like ballet, a little bit of piano, riding.
Yeah, writing, all of that.
So are all of your books just going to be based on like lessons you took when you were a kid? Is there going to be like a tumbling?
I was waiting for Rachel
I can't write as good of a gymnastics book as Megan Abbott, so I am going to, I'm going to set that and just bow down to her. No, it's a little bit about, I'll start with, a collection of items or, the various things that I want to bring in. But a lot of the time, there'll be something that I'm thinking about that I start with a scene that comes to mind, and then I build out around there based on just the vibes. So the first scene that came to me here was actually in Ingenue was the first scene, what ended up being the opening to the book. And like that's already
Sorry, I'm
very
like,
fantasy. And I was just,
yeah, I'm like,
yeah,
you had me there.
and all of, for example, we have so the there's a series of what she calls the haunted violins in her house. And those are real, like this is an unfinished
Props!
Violin. It's a haunted violin that I was like, I always wanted to write about those and, bring in. And the family dog was really sick and he was a husky and, getting really old. And it was pandemic time. And so, I couldn't get back to see him. So I wanted to write in just a dog that was just fine. Although everybody opens the book and it's like, oh my God, there's
The
a dog.
dog's good. Yeah.
Dog.
I just like him, okay?
That's there's no there he is, like he's a wolf, and he's kind of fairy tale-esque, but also I just wanted to write a dog and
I thought because the beginning was strong and dark and then you introduced the dog a little bit later, I'm like, I feel like the dog's gonna be fine because everything else can go wrong, so the dog's gonna be fine.
I
Had
didn't
everything been great at the beginning and it was just like, and then there's an old dog, I was like, uh-oh.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Nope.
Yeah, exactly.
Like I'll read like any gross dark thing, but it's just like, do not harm the dog.
That's it. Laura Ingalls Wilder really messed me up, just having my mom sob reading when, the dog dies in that. And no, it's I can't. I can't.
I don't remember the dog dying. I remember a cow dying. Doesn't the cow die?
Maybe.
Remember the cow named Sookie, because then I named my cat Sookie. And this was before Sookie Stackhouse. So, I mean, people were like, oh, your cat was named Sookie for the Stackhouse. I'm like, no, for the cow and Laura Ingalls Wilder. It made sense to me. That's fine. I wanted to know, though, you have some characters who they have minor scenes in terms of placement in the book, but ones that just stick with you, including a certain female character who I just wanted to strangle with my bare hands for her opinions and her
Yes.
attitude.
I was like, wait, which one? Oh, never mind.
No, oh, you know which one. I mean, there are multiple female characters that you can see yourselves in different ways. And Lord help me, if I ever am that person, everyone has permission to pull me aside and smack me. Please tell me you don't know that person in real life. Like that there's no real person that's based on or
No, I don't write based on real people. I couldn't. I mean, it was really.
I'm like, what? You don't? Oh, God, now I feel really terrible about everybody I write about. I mean, all the fictional people I write about.
They're all fictional.
Right.
Well, I feel like it's easy for them to be more fictional the further you get away from your real life. Like when you write books that are like very much, I don't want to say based on you, but like based on your world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's easy to go, oh, I'm just going to base this one on, and I'm not talking about the ballerinas. I'm talking about my current work in progress, which is about ballroom dancing. I'm like, oh, that's clearly like, and murder.
that's my favorite combo. Like, X dancing plus murder.
It works. It works.
I know. I pitched it to my agent. I was just like, is Dolores Claiborne meets Dirty Dancing a thing? And she's like, maybe. It could be. Like, I think that's what I'm writing.
She's Jennifer, like, what are you doing?
I know. She's like, just don't make your main character a murderer. And I'm like, I don't know if she
quickly change the topic.
I know. I'm like, I don't know.
She'll
and
be
I don't know if she is because I'm such a pantser that I'm just like,
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I'm just going to say, because there are a variety of women characters in this book beyond your main character. And there were parts when I first started reading Saskia, I'm like, I don't relate to her. I was never a prodigy. But what you do bring out is that feeling of expectation. And so for any of us, like, I will say this is the book, even if you weren't a prodigy, this is the book for all of you gifted kids out there who thought you'd be like amazing and you're really not so amazing in real life now because everyone had all these expectations of what you would be when you're grown up. And you're like, and now it's just life and it's not so much. You nailed that. And that
you were so smart. You learned to read so early. Look at those little poems you wrote when you were 8. You were amazing. And now you're like, I'm 40 and a failure.
Can't be a precocious adult. It's the heartbreak of my life.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it goes like, from precocious child to like weirdo with a home studio / workshop where you just go in there and you're like, I don't know. This is where I'm the weirdo. I'm working, and you just like scream that to nobody because nobody cares.
No one was even paying attention to what you're doing. You screamed, and they're like, "Shut up, dude!"
I know, they're like, "Why are you yelling?"
I don't know.
I'm just gonna make click clack sounds on my computer for a little.
But you totally nailed that feeling. And again, not a prodigy, but again, that expectation of the gifted child who everyone thought would just be so amazing as an adult, and now they're like, "And what are you doing? And what is Saskia's job?" She's like writing test questions for SATs for
something. Oh my god! What a great job!
Awesome.
This is actually my day job.
Is it really?
Yes.
I love that. See, and I love that everybody's like, and then you did coding? Like the descent from musical genius to you touch computers. I love how like everyone's looking down and like pretty sure computers make good money. I'm not sure why they're so upset, but it doesn't have that fun of like, oh, award-winning
whole Carnegie Hall.
Yes. There's no Carnegie Hall for computers.
Yeah,
I mean, there probably is, but
artistic. Yeah, I wouldn't know what it is. MIT. I think that there's a real privilege that this family is unaware of, you know, this artistic and cultural privilege that, you know, they're aware that they're wealthy or were once and
or appear wealthy. And sometimes that's all that matters.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that they take this kind of education and this culture for granted in a lot of ways. And it's really interesting to kind of play around with people's blind spots a bit. With characters.
Not in real life, not like just gaslighting people.
Yeah.
All these are fictional things we're talking about here. This is fiction. Absolutely fiction. Well, I know at one point since Jennifer had read it ahead of me and I was listening to it, I'm like, this book is making me mad. They're talking about how much royalties this woman's getting for her fairy tale books. I should go write fairy tale books.
I'm like, unrealistic.
My mom was making some nice chunks of change for her feminist theory fairy tales for children, and
that in itself is a kind of fairy tale, you know.
You're like, if I write it can happen.
She has a series of them, so you know, she at a certain point there's 20 something of these things all bringing in, you know, royalties at the same time. So that's how I justify it.
I think it's justified at that point.
It's not one book in that amount of money. Exactly. It's 20 books and maybe some of, like, they all bring in just enough.
Yes. Well, I think it's true, especially the thing about kids writing is every generation, or not even generation, but every few years, you have a new audience who's ready for those books. Because, okay, so my kids have read all of the Elephant and Piggy books. Shout out to my moms. There are more kids being born who are going to want those books too. Keep buying them. You can make bank. Whereas for adults, it's like, once you write a book for an adult, you don't get new readers for another 20 years or so because you're all kind of in that same age group. Whereas if you're writing for 7-year-olds, we're getting new 7-year-olds every 2 years, honestly.
every year, really.
I'm just saying there's like that window what does the book appeal to? And I have that issue right now. My eldest is eating through books so quickly, I can't keep her in books. And I'm going,
Isn't she at the age when she can read Flowers in the Attic yet?
I wouldn't even let her watch our interview with Andrew Niederman, let alone let her read any of the books. Are you kidding me? No.
I'm just saying I turned out fine.
That is a very formative experience for our generation. And you know,
I wouldn't allow you to read them now. I just come straight into Anne Rice.
Don't ask for permission. You ask for forgiveness.
Uh-huh.
If I had asked my parents, first of all, I don't think they had any clue what it was.
No, I think my parents were like, oh, you bought that at the grocery store? Mm-hmm. And it was like right next to Bop magazine and Tiger Beat and gum. Mm-hmm.
And gum.
Gum's so fine. It's got to be fine. Mm-hmm. And it's just a cover of like young blonde girls. Yeah. And like, I think it's a fairy tale.
Ballet in it.
There's ballet in it. It's a ballet book. It's about family. It's about generational family things.
Yeah.
They all live together in one house.
Very, very wholesome.
They love their family.
Wrong way, Jennifer.
Okay. Well, I did a wink for those of you who are only listening to the audio.
You can't hear the wink. Wink louder.
Oh, then I'm just blinking both eyes.
Okay. Yeah,
I'm like, nope, that didn't work.
But yeah, I mean, I can see how if she was a successful fairy tale or writing for younger audiences, that would totally catch on. So I will allow your math. Also, I can't math. So, I mean, I'm sure it's fine. I actually
have and I'm just going to say
she should be fine with that amount of money. Stop being so greedy, Saskia.
The idea of fairy tales for little feminists is not just a book that appeals to children. It appeals to the mothers of all these children. So it's a double audience.
Yeah, because who is reading these books, especially in the 80s? You know, who is reading them out loud? It is primarily the mothers.
Mm-hmm. Thinking, this is what I want my daughter to be reading, not any of that Disney stuff.
Exactly.
Like a little less gruesome than the actual Grimm's Tale version of it. Where
not quite as gruesome as the, what was it, How to Be Eaten. I read that one not long ago. Did I make you read that? I think I put that on your list. We'll talk later.
Okay, I'm like, no, I did not read How to Be Eaten, and that can be taken a lot of different ways.
This is why I'm not allowed in the library anymore. I'm kidding. It was on my app.
Like,
it was on my cloud library app. It was an Audible. You know me. I'm always picking up something, and if the cover looks interesting, I'm like, click. Assuming I don't have something that I'm supposed to be listening to for our show, I have to have something in my ears at all times. Like, silence? No, I can't function in that. No.
Nobody can. So Rachel, we're really excited about the next book.
Thank you.
Tarot cards and horse riding is just a combination I never thought to put together. So very thrilled. I do want to thank you. I just want to thank you for writing the ballerinas and the ingenue because they were great. I haven't read Graduates in Wonderland, but I did order it because I was just like, I love your voice. And now I want to get to know your best friend. And
it's a funny thing because
live vicariously through whatever, because my 20s didn't look like I think your 20s did. I wasn't anywhere cool.
I was
in the Midwest the whole time. That's where I moved to get cool.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, when it first came out and people would read it, it was a little embarrassing, especially when it's people you know reading, you know, it's almost like your journal emails with your best friend. But now it's so funny because these are emails from when I was 22, which was last year. No, but like it was a long time ago.
It was just like 2 years ago. I mean, you've matured so much.
But, you know, it's so funny because people that I, you know, people who are acquaintances of friends and things like that will, you know, pass it. It was circulating the friend group for a while, a copy of it. And I'm going, oh God, but these people are going to think of me as like how I was when I was 22 and just boy crazy and, you know, all of this stuff.
They were 22 once also. Hopefully they all were. A little bit of grace and understand that it's not written like right now.
Yeah. I should clarify, it's not that I'm not still boy crazy, but.
For the record, viewers. Yes.
For the record. Now she's man crazy.
Now she's man crazy. And her website is just scrolling underneath. She might have a contact form. We're not telling you to send anything disgusting to her, but maybe maybe a poem in a really vintage form of writing.
I'm just imagining you say that without your mom. I'm just like, she writes dirty limericks because that was my takeaway. And I don't think that's probably what you meant. But that was
your takeaway? Dirty limericks? I was really going for like off-time sonnets and things like that. I'm like, oh, I get that.
When I think of weird forms of poetry, it's always either haiku, which I know how to sing, and that's how you know whether or not it's got the right structure, or dirty limericks, you know.
Those are at least...
Those are the two basics.
All we got taught in elementary school, that's all I came away with.
Limericks.
No literary degree.
Rachel, thank you so, so much for being here. Everybody who caught this show live or is just listening to it on the replay or watching us on the replay, we actually have another show tomorrow. We took last week off, and now we're doubling up this week. So tomorrow we have Amanda Giatissa talking about her book, You're Invited. And it is at a strange time for me, 7:30 p.m. 7:30 Eastern.
For you, 4:30 for me, 5 a.m. for her in the future.
All the way from Sri Lanka, everyone.
In Sri Lanka, what are you going to do?
Amazing. This week's theme was not just books I read during COVID. It was international. Also, revenge.
Yeah, there's a lot of that too.
Well, so thank you guys so much for having me on.
Thank you.
It's delightful to talk with you.
Thank you so much. And everybody, see you tomorrow.
Bye.